Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. My name is Pavi, and I'm your host for this week's Global Awaken Call. Welcome and thank you all for joining us. Every story is the beginning of a conversation, whether it's with ourselves or with others. The purpose of these weekly calls is to share stories from changemakers who are lighting up our world. Our hope is that these conversations will plant seeds for a more compassionate and service-oriented society while serving to foster our own inner transformation. Behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this beautiful space. We're thankful to them and to all our listeners for helping co-create this space. Today we're grateful to have with us Kaylin Sullivan, more widely known as Two Trees, whose personal journey straddles multiple cultures and surfaces humanity's powerful potential. Thank you again for joining today's call. We'll begin with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves in this space. Welcome again to our weekly Awaken Call, today in conversation with Two Trees. Here's how the call works. In a few minutes, our moderator, Aria Cooper-Smith, will engage in dialogue with our speaker, Two Trees, and by the top of the hour, we'll roll into Q&A and a circle of sharing, where we invite your reflections and questions. The queue is open right now, so at any point during the call, you can hit *6 on your phone, and you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. You can also email us at ask@servicespace.org. Today, as I mentioned, we have the pleasure of having Aria as our moderator, and I'd like to do a brief introduction to him. Aria Cooper-Smith is a dear friend and volunteer with Service Space and is the founder of One World Lights, a community of global citizens with the shared vision of people everywhere supporting a course change for humanity by supporting each other. He is also an accomplished writer and the author of Holy Beggars, A Journey from Hate Street to Jerusalem, a memoir of a student, a spiritual teacher, and the spiritual revolution in 1960s San Francisco. Together with his wife, Wendy, he convenes the Coastside Torah Circle, where people from different backgrounds gather to study sacred Jewish texts, and where the circle is the teacher. He is a poet, a lover of nature, and just a remarkably open-hearted individual and a fantastic storyteller, and it's a joy to have him moderating this conversation today. Aria, I'm going to pass the baton over to you to do an introduction to Two Trees and get the ball rolling on this conversation.
Wow, thank you, Pavi, for that generous introduction. Hello, everyone. Before I introduce our speaker, I want to acknowledge and thank all the Awaken Call team of volunteers behind the scenes who make this call and all of our weekly calls possible. And special thanks this week to you, Pavi, and also to Prabha, Nikhil, Audrey, and Nipun for some special efforts that happened to make sure that we have the necessary web of technology and people in place for this conversation. So thanks to you all. And Kaylin Sullivan Two Trees, thank you so much for joining us today for sharing the heart space, mind space, and earth space for this global conversation. To me, the timing seems very special, as we were just talking about a few minutes ago, as we're in the midst of changing seasons here in the Northern Hemisphere. And based on our earlier conversation that you and I had, I also sense an inflection point in how you're viewing your life journey, which I'd like to explore later as part of this conversation. So welcome.
Thank you so much, Aria. And I'm really honored to be here, and I want to start first with immense gratitude for you opening the circle of embrace, as you called it, Pavi, of the Awaken community, and for letting me be in conversation with you all. It's a great honor, and I'm really excited to be connected to all of you wherever you are, to the ancestors and the places that you occupy and bring to the conversation.
All right. Yeah, and thank you for mentioning the ancestors, too. So just a little bit by way of introduction, everyone, to Two Trees, that when you read about her on the Awaken website, the first thing you saw was her statement about herself. And I'm going to quote that because it's really key. So she says, "By birth, education, and experience, my identity is shaped by a life at the crossroads, the place where cultures, ideas, and beliefs collide and find both dissonance and resonance. I am most comfortable with those explorers and cartographers whose passion and life is the crossroads. There, at any given moment, what is magic and what is real shifts places depending on where I stand. Two Trees is an artist, writer, artist in residence at the University of Vermont, and a member of the university's leadership team for the Leadership in Sustainability Master's Program of the university's Rubenstein School of Environment and Natural Resources. She's also been a Wistanen public scholar at the Kettering Foundation and artist in residence for the Vermont Network. Over the course of the past four decades, Two Trees has evolved a framework of spiritual technology with the input, support, and guidance of many Indigenous elders. And this, the current practice, the current expression of this is called Practice for Living, Living Practice, which focuses on helping humans reorient to our Indigenous mind. And I just want to read you, to sort of get a flavor for how this is, I want to read you one sentence from their website, her website. So here it is. Practice for Living, Living Practice is a continuing collaboration between Kaylin Sullivan Two Trees and the Earth. So that's her partner, the Earth. Okay. And so with that, I think we'll move from introduction to hearing a little bit from Two Trees. And Two Trees, I guess where I'd like to start our conversation is, there's one thing more that I wanted to share that I noticed on the website. I see here in my notes, because I think this is important. And living practice, what I noticed were some of these words, dynamic regeneration. We participate in creation. The keys for tapping into this regenerative power are remember, embody, model, share. Remember, embody, model, share. So Two Trees, I guess where I really want to start is to ask you, can you say a little bit about that practice?
Oh, I could probably go on for a really long time, but I'm trying to think about an entry point that makes sense in this context. And I would say that, you know, the thing that you pulled out about remember, embody, model, and share is something that I've been attending to for a long time, and it has to do with dreaming. Our ability to dream both deep into the past of our ancestors, all the way back to the stars, and also to dream forward into the future that we want for the seven generations following us. And, you know, we know that the dream state, we can tell deep dream state by REM, you know, the rapid eye movements. And that actually made me think about this, oh, what are the REMs for it? Like having, living into a dreaming state as a perpetual state for how we live in the world and how we hold ourselves in the world. And that's kind of the framework. And it means that we're paying attention in a multidimensional way to our actions, their impacts in the world, and that we're also gaining insight, inspiration, and learning from the earth that we are part of. That nature for me is a way of kind of seeing divine energy at work. And when there are changes in the patterns of the and the flow of divine energy on the earth, we see it through the way the earth manifests changes. And so using that as a learning tool for ourselves in terms of how we might adapt and open ourselves. So it means paying exquisite attention to our larger context, both this planet and all the way into the cosmos, but also down to the minute level, you know, the microcilia and the root systems of the earth and the way that they can inform us. So that's kind of the first level of attention of the practice is
just
really...
level?
Yeah. That was a lot, I know. So you have to tell me when to stop.
Oh, no, this is great. Keep going. Go ahead.
I think I start in the practice with being aware of ourselves as a detail of our landscape, human, non-human, and invisible. And how do we ingrain practices in our life on a minute-to-minute scale that remind us that we're being breathed by this planet, that the breath that is an automatic function of our bodies is a response to the planet that we live on. It's a response to the green on the planet. It's a response to the one breath that connects everything.
Okay, so I want to ask something. Let's say that I'm a typical American person living in an urban or maybe a suburban area. And, you know, I've been sort of raised in this culture. But I want to tune in more. So, like, in a concrete way, what are some things that I can begin doing to sort of opening up those channels of tuning into the life of the planet that you're talking about?
The seasons change wherever you are. There's even in the most concrete place. I mean, the place I started teaching this practice is Manhattan.
Oh, wow.
And so, the weeds and the cracks in the sidewalk, the ivy on abandoned buildings, the movement of the green that you see, the change of light in the sky, starting with becoming aware of that and starting to become aware of your non-human neighbors. That's a start. And your context actually does not deprive you of this. I've worked with men in prison and practices for them, even in solitary,
wow,
to reconnect to that one breath. Our breath is a gateway. And it's an automatic function. So turning our awareness to our breath to reconnect us to the green is something that we can do anywhere.
Yeah. So I'm hearing two things. One is start with whatever green or earth is closest to you right now. And two is start connecting with the breath.
Yeah, those are definitely two things. And whatever earth is available to you now can be, you know, I'm sitting here at a desk, it's made of wood, and I can connect, I can open my attention to remember that this wooden desk came from a tree. Can I open my awareness to follow this piece of wood all the way back to its home in that tree? And one of the things that people ask me all the time is, well, is that really a connection or is that imagination? Am I making that up? And one of the things that I think is really important and particularly important at a time like we're in the world is to reignite the imagination in service to the work of the soul.
How do we reignite the imagination?
Follow that wooden desk all the way back to that tree. Follow that weed all the way down to the core of the earth through its root system. Follow your sight at night through the glare of lights to the stars that you know are there.
So if I want to do this practice, I can start with whatever I might find near me of the earth, of nature, and just imagine just imagine it backwards?
I think that that's what works for me. I think that what I would say to you is to follow your breath to where it leads you to a connection to nature. And that could be, you know, my wooden desk, or that could be a memory of a place that I inhabited. I mean, lots of times when I live in a very beautiful place in Vermont, and it's gorgeous, and I'm looking out my window right now at a wetland and a meadow and forest behind. But this actually isn't my home landscape. And so sometimes when I am in deep practice, I'm either back in the plains or I'm at Taos Mountain in New Mexico, which are two significant places for me that I can reconnect to that earth energy through that remembering. And then I bring that back here and I go, oh, yeah, you all, you trees here, you know, your cousins, your distant cousins. I'm at a family reunion of distant cousins.
Ah, beautiful. So speaking of going back to the plains, can we talk about a little bit about your story, about how you grew up and how living at the crossroads became a dominant theme in your life?
Well, as I said in that statement, I was by birth, education, and experience. So I was born at the crossroads of three cultures. My father is Lakota, my mother is Congolese and Swedish, and lived in an African-American community in Iowa. And those cultures didn't really have great opinions of one another.
Right.
There was not a big hooray when that marriage occurred, and there was not a big hooray even when I was born. So I feel like from the moment that I came into being, I was at the crossroads between all of those three cultures. I have family from Congo in the United States. My family on the reservation, I spent time between those families. My mother was still getting her degree, and so she sent me to my father's mother, my grandmother, on Pine Ridge Reservation, and I spent a lot of time of my growing up time with her, and then was shipped back to my other grandparents. And each of them had an opinion about the other that was not positive. And so I loved them all, and I loved them as my family, and I loved the stories and teachings and ceremonies and the lineages of ancestors that I could feel from all three directions. And it was not in my nature to discard any of them, but to hold all of them as manifest in me, with all the tension that that implied. And that drew me to places that, some of which were forced on me, and some of which I chose, to constantly be in situations where I was in that kind of tension between cultures and cosmologies and ideologies. And it played out in my artwork. It led me to a career that started in mediation, mostly around indigenous rights, both in the U.S. and in New Zealand, around the Treaty of Waitangi negotiations there. But I found myself really drawn to those places where the tension of difference was a major ingredient of the interactions there. And I really believe that there is a generative energy, you know, the imperative of life. Life happens when there is energy generated, and very often that is around the tension of difference. I mean, seed coats break open through drowning and burning and, you know, some kind of act of tension. And so trying to break open seed coats of consciousness felt like it was a significant part of my work for a long time. And that's what I call crossroads work, where being standing in multiplicity is, and I kind of start a lot of my work and a lot of my teaching these days saying, we're going to start from the place that all stories are true. And then we're going to live into the tension of that and see what can be generated from that.
Wow, you know, I'm just imagining the little girl loving all of her various relatives on mother's side, on father's side, and how they don't necessarily all love each other, and then evolving that into over time into the wisdom of the elder that you're sharing right now. That's quite a journey.
It's never dull, and it's never dull, and it's constantly changing. It's constantly changing. I think that we talked yesterday about the crossroads, and you know, for 4 decades at least, and for the early part of my life. For the early part of my life, I was really more of a warrior, I think. I was much more just really interested in fighting against erasure and invisibility of certain kinds of ways of being. And so the crossroads for me was all about the tension, this generative tension that I just talked about. And in this last decade, I've been exploring how the crossroads might also be a place of surrender to the flow of grace, in the same way you talked about circles in the introduction. Uh-huh. One of you was talking about circles and using the teaching of the circle, and that's definitely both in Lakota and Congolese cosmologies and cultural ceremonies. The circle is self-regulating. It regulates itself. It teaches. It has its own teachings. And so for me, I would have begun to explore how the crossroads may have its own teachings about surrendering as an act of resilience and survivance. And I don't mean surrendering to harm, and I don't mean surrendering to oppression, but I mean surrendering to the way that grace flows through us and that love is manifest in the world, even in the face of oppression and harm. So there's been a kind of transformation or expansion, I would say expansion, because I still work a lot with the tension of the crossroads, but I'm also exploring this idea of surrender. And, you know, I recently discovered the poet Kabir, the Sufi poet Kabir, and I've been reading some of his poems, and they have reminded me of the original instructions of some of my Lakota and Congolese elders that point to this kind of surrender or remember, deep, deep, deep remembering.
This is wonderful. Yeah, when we were talking about your connecting with Kabir's poetry, and then with the music of Prahlad Tipanya, and Wendy and I were kind of blown away by how, you know, how the universe connects itself, you know, and how many people in our service-based community here in the Bay Area have had the opportunity to listen to Prahlaji's music at a concert and to hear the poetry of Kabir. And it seems like it's not a coincidence somehow that you're connecting with all of us.
Yes, it doesn't seem. I was really stunned by that synchronicity as well. And I have been very many indigenous ways of learning, or at least my own way of learning from my elders, was experiential, and there was less influence or attention paid to the words of something than there was to the experience of spirit and ancestors and place and land and our kin in the natural world, our relatives, our deep relationships and our distant kin in the natural world. And so when I discovered Kabir, I was like, that has a voice. My goodness. This is that articulated. I can't quite believe it. I was really stunned. And I, in the mornings when I do my morning greetings, after my morning greetings, I've been listening to Prahlaji as another way of kind of offering gratitude.
Ah, well, I want to come back to Kabir, but right now, since you're mentioning your learning from Lakota elders, I'd like to pivot in that direction, we may, that you lived on a Lakota reservation with your grandmother, and you've shared stories about that. And I want to ask you now, Two Trees, if you can share a story or two that really stands out for you about that time and learning with the Lakota and with your grandmother.
Well, I want to say two things, is that I have Lakota and Congolese elders that I've learned from.
Okay.
And so remember, I'm not going to forget. And I have teachers in Europe from the old religion. So I don't want to diminish any of those elders.
We will not forget any.
I don't want to diminish any of those. But my grandmother is definitely one of, in Hantante, is one of my deepest bedrock teachers. And I'd say that the stories are of remembering kind of deep body memories of being held up to the directions in the morning when I was a baby, and of going foraging and wildcrafting with her and listening to the songs that she sang to the plants that she gathered, talking to them as her relatives and recognizing them in ways that we recognize our relatives. And my favorite, one of my memories that I do remember that I talk about sometimes when I'm talking about her is, she used to say, you know, that you have, she thought I didn't sit still and listen hard enough. And so she would, we would sit in the dark of the new moon, and she had an old quilt, and we would sit outside her cabin in the dark of the new moon, and we would sit for a really long time, and until I thought I was going to fall asleep or jump out of my skin from sitting still for so long and listening to something that she could hear that I wasn't sure I could hear. And just as I was about to fall asleep, or I could tell that the air changed, and in that moment that the air changed, that quilt flicked out into the dark and captured the quills of a porcupine.
Wow.
And that's how we got our quills for quill work in the winter. And so that sense of listening into the dark and listening into the deep silent spaces and having that provide for you, really, that experience and experiences like that are really essential to what the practice is built on.
Wow. So I want to ask you, you were speaking earlier on about awakening, activating the imagination. What's the relationship between imagination and listening into the dark? Is that the same or is that different?
We're in the field of language right now, and we're in the field of language with in English, which is probably, you know, one of the more flat places that we could do this. And so I would say, though, that it's kind of an answer that my grandmother would give. In the beginning was the great mystery, and out of the great mystery all things were born. And so imagination and that kind of deep listening all are focusing our attention back into the great mystery and the womb from which all things come. And so I think in that way they're related. And when the imagination is used in surrender to spirit's calling, our purpose, our calling in this life, in this incarnation, in this time around the wheel, then we're listening all the way back.
Ah, beautiful. Thank you. Wow. Yeah, I hear what you're saying about language, and I get that, and duly noted. So, you know, going back to what you said before, then I want to ask you if there's anything you'd like to share from with us about, you know, wisdom that you learned from your other two backgrounds, from the Congolese, from the European and Swedish, important wisdom that you learned from those streams as well.
There's so much. I really, it's, you know, like there's not enough time and my mouth is too small, both. But I would say that my uncle, Kekia Bunseki Pukiao, was an amazing receptacle and vessel and teacher and sharer of Congo cosmology and ways of being and ways of knowing in this country. And he really taught a lot about kind of the arc of life. It's you know, in Plains culture, it would be called the medicine wheel. In Congo, it's the cosmogram. But kind of understanding...
Cosmic ground?
Pardon?
I'm sorry, the cosmic ground?
The cosmogram.
The cosmogram, got it.
The four moments of the sun, it's called in Congo. And in, you know, in Lakota, it would be the medicine wheel.
Yeah.
Or the Kongleshka Arkan, you know, the sacred hoop. And so I think that... There and Pukiao and Wallace Black Elk spent a lot of time with me together and talking about those things which seemed really to mirror each other in the northern and southern hemispheres and how those teachings could be shared in the world in a way that did not diminish the bedrock of those cultures and what was specific to those cultures. And so I would say that the his teachings around the cosmogram and around the four moments of the sun and our journey in days and lives and movements and the sense of being and re-being over and over again around a center of vital forces, if we remember our source, were essential. And have been essential to me. And I would say also that there are some teachers of mine in the European old religion, particularly in southern France, and some in near the Sami in Scandinavia, that remind me that our understanding of whiteness, my understanding of whiteness,
yeah,
is limited. and I need to expand my understanding of whiteness to include some of those ancestors and the wisdom that they carried as well.
Oh, thank you. Oh, what a tapestry to weave all of that together. You know, I'd like to sort of pivot again and ask you a little bit about your work today. You know, some examples of what you're doing that's most important to you right now with the programs you're involved with in the University of Vermont and elsewhere. How are you, bringing these strands into these programs?
I think the two examples I'd like to point to is the MSLS program, the Masters for Leadership and Sustainability at UVM, and the Vermont Network for Domestic Violence. Those two places right now are kind of key to my work in the world. And one of the things that I feel is really unique about the program is that we're in our third year, that it was designed around the wisdom of nature as a major component of the content. So it was created to actually hold an indigenous worldview and a Western scientific worldview as equally valid and complementary to one another, and to create an environment that was centered around the sacred fire for the program is love, well-being, and learning. Uh-huh. And so it manifests really different in terms of curriculum, and it manifests through a web of relationships rather than the hiring of faculty. I mean, we do have faculty at the university that are part of the university system, but we also have an enormous network of what we call professional affiliates that we have developed through traveling around the world and the country in building relationships with folks over time and space and acknowledging their embodied knowledge as a potential for learning for the students. So I feel... And trying to hold that within the university system is a little tricky, and it's been challenging, but it's also been incredibly rewarding, and it has diversified the student body of our program well beyond the kind of diversity, the standard diversity of the university. So we have a wide range of students from around the world, and we have a kind of vibrant, dynamic learning community that includes those students, the alumni that have now graduated, and these professional affiliates that stay in deep relationship with one another and that are offered possibility to stay in deep relationship with one another, both through the program and through what we call the Crossroads Leadership Lab. So the kind of design and birthing and I feel like I'm a part of this great organism of relationships that has made this program possible, and we continue to steward and shepherd that through and learn from both nature and each other. So that feels like a big piece in terms of the kind of bringing that kind of indigenous mind into a learning environment in a way that's accessible to more people. And
indigenous mind into a, what'd you say, a university environment that's acceptable to more people. I mean, that's an amazing undertaking. I guess I'm curious. I'm curious about the students when they come to your program. Why do they come? What are they expecting? What are they wanting in terms of their lives that you're offering?
I would say that most of them have been trying something that has not worked. They're passionate about their work in the world. Most of them are mid-career professionals, or a lot of them are, and they have tried things, social change efforts particularly, in this world and that have not found them to be as successful as they envision, and are looking for a different way of conceiving of that work. And so that takes them on some really spectacular journeys. Some of them change jobs, change profession, change where they live in the course of the two-year program. Some of them redesign their kind of environmental work to really include a social justice component, which was never part of how they were thinking before. And so I think that they're looking for transformation.
They're looking for transformation.
Internal transformation. I mean, everyone who comes, I think, is clearly passionate about transforming the world. But they're also realizing, you know, that the internal conditions that we embody are part of how we transform. I mean, it's an inside-out leadership program.
So you're talking about transforming yourself, transforming the world, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And
well,
it includes contemplation and awareness practice. As part of the curriculum. It includes creativity as part of the curriculum. It includes being able to actually build increased capacity to work across difference as part of the curriculum from a place of love and well-being, which are different, really different ways of getting after some of these things.
Yeah. You know, a word that is popping into my mind is the word career. That, you know, typically, mostly, people who go to college think about their career. How is this going to prepare me for a good, satisfying, rewarding, remunerative career? From your perspective, and you think about career, what is that about for you? What is that about for your students?
We encourage our students to perhaps put aside the idea of career temporarily while they're at least in the first year of the program, to actually listen deeply for their calling. And I would say for me, that's actually all that I want to listen to. I'm not so focused on a career, and if you look at my resume, you can kind of see it's like, oh, there's a big zing there from professional artist to, you know, mediation. I mean, it runs all over the place. And it's because I'm following something that is my calling. I'm not following a career path.
If you look at your quote-unquote resume from the lens of career, it doesn't make too much sense. If you look at it from the lens of calling, it all is a one piece.
It's all a body of work, yes. That is a response to my calling. And so if you think about the MSLS program as, you know, kind of academic and working with curriculum design and curriculum development and the delivery of curriculum and all of that, that's one thing I'm doing. And the other thing I'm doing is working with the Vermont Domestic Violence Network to reignite imagination in their staff and their counselors and their lawyers to help them to renew, find their own interior resilience, and also to dream a world beyond that of adversarial positions and polarization, and to have one that's focused on healing for all. And love. And so the work I'm doing with them has nothing to do about curriculum. It has to do with play and imagination and opening up the body and learning, understanding that the hands in the body know things that the brain doesn't know. So that's a completely different kind of work. And it all feels much of a muchness to me.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. As we're getting close to the top of the hour, and in a few minutes I'll be turning this over to Pavi for questions from the community. There's a couple more questions I want to ask you, Tutrees. And by the way, I want to remind everyone listening that if you would like to ask a question, you can dial star 6 on your phone, and you'll be prompted into the queue. And you can also email it at Pavi, what's the email address?
It's ask@servicespace.org.
ask@servicespace.org, right. I wanted to make sure I got that right, got the org instead of the com. ask@servicespace.org. Okay, so Tutrees, one question that I want to ask you that we were also covering a little bit in our previous conversation is, given the world we're living in today, you know, you just mentioned polarization. In this country, in the U.S., there is so much polarization. We see a current government in Washington that seems committed to the exact opposite of stewardship of the earth, of tearing down stewardship, of sort of increasing the exploitation of resources, of people, of fermenting destructive polarization. So how does what you're talking about, your programs, your work, speak about the connection and the relevance in the world as in some of the forces that we're currently seeing?
Oh, that's a big question. But I would say that one of the things that is true for me and how I come to my program, because I don't want to speak for everyone in that network that is part of the program, but I would say for myself is that it is really essential for me as a detail of the landscape that is undergoing great changes and impact from humans, is that I am careful. It's listening. I'm careful to not react, because then I will spend all of my energy reacting to the continuous blows rather than finding the place that I can actually find true resistance and resilience. And so I think that the way that what we're bringing to the program are the tools for resistance and resilience and survivance in response to the human conditions and the way that the earth is responding to them. And that does not mean that I think there's one way to do that. I think there's direct action when impact is severe and traumatic. I think that there is long game action that requires deep reflection so that it's not reactive and really sees itself working for the seven generations coming after us. And I think that there's intervening in harm at the moment. So I think it's a complex set of problems that we have, which requires complex kinds of solutions and not single solutions. But I do believe that building people's capacity for states of embodied knowledge and opening to grace, I'm going to call it grace, is one of the strong tools of social action.
Ah, so yeah, we could go there, but I want to go with grace. Thank you. I want to go with grace, and I want to go back to Kabir. To me, one of the most remarkable things that you said to me when we spoke earlier is that you have, at this stage of your life, decided to learn Hindi. Can you say more about that? That's a big commitment. Why are you learning Hindi?
Well, you know, the cultures that I come from, and particularly my uncle, Phukyao, he always said you can never really understand something or feel the heart of something in translation. That if you really want to know the heart of Congo, you have to know it in Kikongo. If you really want to know the heart of even the most simple of words in Lakota, like Ho Medakyo Yasin, you need to know that in its own language, in its own place in that language. And I'm so fascinated by Kabir and also by Pelaju's interpretation and him as a vessel of Kabir. And I know that they have workshops in Lunyakeri, where he lives. And I'd love to go, but I would only go, one, if I was invited, because you need to be invited onto a land, and two, to receive those poems in some kind of understanding of their own language, in their own language. So it's from my own training, actually, that I don't feel like I can enter too far into that without entering into the language.
Why Kabir? What is it about Kabir that has connected with you so strongly?
The crossroads. I mean, he sounds like the voice of the crossroads to me. Can I give you a couple of examples?
Yes.
So there are two pieces from his poems that one is, within the heart a mirror, but no face shows. You'll see your face when your heart's duality goes. That, to me, sounds like a lot of the teachings of Congo that I know from experience, but I didn't, there was no language for. And this one, everyone came from one place and took the same road. Halfway along, you fell into doubt, suddenly 12 roads. And it sounds like the sacred hoop, you know, like Grandpa Wallace was always talking about, well, you'll hear them talk about this kind of this and this kind of that, but it's all because they don't remember that it's all the same. So every time I hear a song or a poem, it connects, and it could be the lens I'm using, but it connects me back to these teachings of my own elders in this new way through language, which is another reason that I want to actually hear them and have some understanding of them in their own language.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, that is, those quotes are very moving, and your relationship with them is very moving.
And I could be completely misinterpreting. You know, I want to preface all that I just said by saying that actually my mouth is too small to speak about Kabir at the moment.
Right.
Because I'm only getting it through translation.
Yeah, you're getting it through someone else's mind, and you want to encounter it directly, yeah. So you said something earlier. For my last sort of thought or question for you to offer any reflections on, you talked about how growing up and then for most of your life, being at the crossroads, living at the crossroads, was about the creative possibilities of tension between these various systems, values, cultures that people have. And now at this time of your life, you've shifted that rather than it being about tension, it's about surrender. So I just want to ask you, you know, if there's any further reflections you'd like to offer on what does that mean in a practical sense? What's the difference in the kinds of actions that I choose if I'm going to choose living in the creative tension versus in the state of surrender?
I actually don't know if I can answer that question in response to the concrete, because I think that that's a spiritual and philosophical shift,
uh-huh,
rather than a behavioral shift.
Uh-huh.
And so I think the shift in the intention is has to do with the stage of my life, you know. And I think that when we shift intention, our actions change. But I couldn't I don't know that I can talk clearly about the concrete changes in behavior, because I'm just living into the shift in intention. And so I know that people around me say that something's different. But, you know, I'm in my seventh decade, and I'm really looking, feeling my responsibility to dream the world that my great-grandchildren are stepping into. And that has meant that I can focus on tension, which has been really generative, you know, really unlaminating the difference between tension and conflict is a huge piece of work. And I'm happy with all of that work. And it's been a service, and it's also been deeply rewarding. And I also think that at this stage, I want to surrender to the flow of grace through me in those moments of tension for a new possibility to exist in me. And that's what I can carry with me, which is a little different than being the vehicle for that to happen, for that tension to create possibilities for everyone around me in situations that are highly charged, which has been my work to date.
Yes. You actually have answered my question too, Therese. thank you. So, Pavi, it's that time. I'd like to turn the conversation over to you if you're ready.
Sure. Thank you so much, both of you. It's been a fascinating hour listening to the conversation, and I'm excited to ask a few questions of my own and also remind listeners that to add a question to the queue, just dial *6 and you'll be added to the queue, or you can write to us at ask@servicebase.org. Titrith, one of the things I was struck by, many things, but just listening to you, and, you know, there seems to be a certain detachment to, you know, kind of the typical outcome orientation of our world, with whether it's career or just, you know, the worldly things. And I'm sure a lot of that comes from your indigenous roots, but I was struck by something you wrote in the the response to the five questions you were asked ahead of the call, and where you had mentioned a period of being homeless. And I was wondering what, you know, if you could speak a little bit about that and how your experiences of loss have shaped you and also perhaps brought you to some of the richness of awareness that you have.
Yeah. So, you know, the tension and conflict and the impacts of colonization and oppression on the communities that I come from is pretty intense. And it creates life conditions that are really challenging, violent, and difficult. And when my children were small, we fell prey to those circumstances. I mean, we ended up in a halfway house, and I think that I experienced loss, but I also experienced the power of survivance. I really experienced, I think that I have to own that I think I came in with a warrior's heart, and that kind of loss really fired up in me the idea that you cannot get me down. My ancestors are still here 500 years later after all that's happened, and you can't get me down. I fought my way out of that. But I think that I fought my way out of that standing on the shoulders of my grandmother on the res, who never let me understand ourselves as poor. And I think that I did that standing on the shoulders of my Swedish ancestors, who decided to free their slaves and bring them north and give them land. I mean, there are a lot of shoulders I was standing on to get there and to fight, because they survived. And so there's something about creating stories of strength rather than stories of victimization that is deeply implanted in me. And I think that it's implanted by my ancestors and their strength. And that the practices are ways of expressing and embodying that in the great going forward. But the strength of it is in standing on the shoulders of my ancestors who survived. And I mean human ancestors and distant cousin ancestors, mountains and, you know, the Black Hills and Fernwood placentas buried and deserts and plains and all of that as well, all the way back to the stars, which is where we say we came from. I hope that answers your question.
No, it does, in a powerful way. Thank you for sharing that, and for the courage that you brought to the difficulties and the challenges on your path, and a gratitude to your ancestors as well. In a similar vein, I was struck by something you mentioned very briefly in your responses to the questions, and that was the turning point in 1984 when you had a near-death experience. Could you share a little bit more about that and the teachings that came from the intensity of that?
A couple things came from that. One is I don't even know how to talk about it at the moment, but that what came from it first was that it's probably one of the most joyful experiences I've ever had in my life. Not the actually collapsing and out of body kind of experience of the moment itself, but the coming back into the body filled with such. It's the most joyful. It sustains me to this day, the sense of joy of both the coming and the going that I've been able to, that really, it's a big part of who I am now. I just have a tremendous joy at being here and a tremendous joy at being able to go home someday. And so I think that was an enormous turning point because, you know, the story you asked me before, it was about survivance and it was about stories of strength and it was about, you know, being freaked out, terrified, and having to find the heart to go forward and fight. And there was something about this experience that changed that in the same way that I'm talking about the change from working with tension to working with surrender. It was a pivot point that changed working from that place of, you know, fear and to working from a place of joy. And I don't mean happiness. I mean joy. I mean joy in the face of the struggle to get back on my feet again, which took about a year. The struggle to not be working for a year and have no money for a year. All of that struggle, I'm not diminishing that at all, but the struggle happened from a place of joy, which was a huge difference.
Wow. That seems like another crossroads or a place of creative tension there that's really, really profound. Thank you for that answer. And we do have a caller in the queue. I'm going to pass the baton on to him.
Great. Thank you.
Hi, Two Trees. Thank you so much for sharing this indigenous wisdom with us. I have a question for you. My name is Kozo, and I'm in Cupertino. I have a question for you. I was talking to a Hawaiian elder once, and we were having a really deep conversation, and she said, you know, we're not really talking to each other right now. Our ancestors are talking to each other. And I'm wondering if you, because you're at that crossroads, if you've had that experience where you feel your ancestors talking to each other, either actually in the physical plane, like have your ancestors ever talked to each other and come together in a way, or also in, you know, a more mystical spiritual plane, talking together through you or through dreams or through experiences you've had?
Well, as I said earlier, you know, I had the grace for Grand Wallace Black Elk and Tata Fukiao to spend time together and to be my elders together. So that's my ancestors talking to each other for sure. But what's true is that every circle that I am in and every circle that I facilitate or even am a part of, I'm there with my ancestors and as the vessel for my ancestors to be in relationship with and in conversation with and communion with the ancestors of those who are in the circle with me. And the circle is the vehicle by which that is made possible. So it's a constant activity, actually. I don't think it's an extraordinary activity. I think it's a constant intentioned activity. And I think it's both extraordinary, ordinary, mystical, and everyday, profane, all at the same time.
Wow. I'm curious about, you know, you have ancestors that come from Europe, and then you have, you know, your indigenous ancestors and your African ancestors. And obviously, you know, Europeans were in conflict with the indigenous people and have those European ancestors made peace with the indigenous ancestors?
Well, all three of those people have been in conflict with each other in various ways over the course of history as people. But, you know, it's a little bit like that last Kabir poem that I read. Everyone came from one place and took the same road. In the world of the ancestors, I have access to all of them in a way that without the conflict, but with a multiplicity of flows of grace, I guess, and perspective from the ancestor world that I wouldn't have gotten from them, particularly maybe in the physical world. And I have to say that even bringing Fukia together with Grandpa Wallace, it took some doing on the physical. You know, it wasn't. So there's something about when we talk about these things, you know, in these kinds of settings, it all sounds so seamless and effortless. And I want to be really clear that all of this happens both in the flow of grace and with some effort, just with some human effort born out of intention.
Mm-hmm.
And can be a little spiky at moments. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me. And it reminds me of a saying and from Islam, and they say, you know, trust in Allah, but tie up your camel. You know,
it's
not all grace. You don't just sit and wait and let the grace come. You also have to tie up your camel, watch over your children, you know, be active. Thank you.
Yes, that's a great saying, yes.
I don't want to take too much time, but I just wanted to just honor how in yourself, you know, you are bringing those tribes together in peace, you know, and that's just a beautiful thing to see, you know, somebody who actually is the crossroads of all three of all those cultures, and living that in peace, and it brings me a lot of inspiration, it brings me a lot of hope, and I'm just so grateful for your presence in that, you're occupying that space in such a peaceful manner, so thank you.
We have to be grateful to my parents too, and a meeting of unlikely souls. Thank you.
Thank you, Koso, for that question. Teachers, I was looking at some of the titles of the books that you've brought into the world, and they have such beautiful titles. There's one from capital I to little I. There's one called Spirit, Space, and Survival, another called Somebody Always Singing to You. And there's one called Searching for the 13th Moon, a Lunar Book of Days. Could you share a little bit about that one? I was intrigued by the description.
Well, I have always been, my grandmother was, she was kind of an embodiment of moon teachings, I would say. And so the connection to the moons was really strong. And that kind of, that lives in me. And I've always been interested in the shift to the Gregorian calendar of 12 moons from the 13 moons of the lunar cycles. And in Lakota, the names of the moons have to do with what's happening on the land. And so it's, you know, if I've been kind of nomadic in my life. This is my 57th move.
Wow.
In my life, where I live now. And so I wanted to understand how to keep connection to those moons and to name them in relationship to my own body in the place that I was and what was happening in the place. And I wanted to see if I thought that perhaps that might be an activity that other women might want to be engaged in, to name and count their lives in their place in relationship to the moon and their bodies, because naming and counting are such acts of power. And so I developed these practices for paying attention to the 13 moons in your place on both the physical and the mental, emotional, and spiritual levels. And it became a kind of and I worked with women all over the country and in the Southern Hemisphere, naming and counting their moons over, I think we did it for 4 years, just as a process. And it was lovely.
Wow, what a beautiful gift. Is that it? And that book is available?
That book is out of print.
Okay. We'll have to talk more about that. We have another caller with a question in the queue. Wendy?
Hi, Two Trees. Good talking to you again, and thank you for your wisdom as you share to so many of us. My first question is, you've kind of gone into it a little bit with your answering the last question, but I am curious also about any other rituals that you do during these times of blending, times of change, both in the physical world, what's around us, like we had talked about, morning to afternoon to evening, like today, or even in times of our lives. A change of one status to another. So I'd like to just start with that.
We had this conversation before, and I think that one of the things that everything that I talk about in relationship to being earth-centered starts with being in relationship with the Great Turning. And that means the shift of light in the day, changing light in the morning at dawn and changing light in the evening at night, but also the peaks of the day, high noon and midnight, and then the changes on the planet at the different seasons, whatever hemisphere you're in, those cross-quarter days between the equinoxes and solstices, that actually those moments of transition are the moments when the veil between the spirit world, the invisible world, and our world are the thinnest. And so those are times of deep practice. And I would say that the first practice in terms of ritual, I think that the times in the place call for their own ritual. And I think all rituals don't apply to all places. And so it is an act of deep listening into what the place calls for in response to the Great Turning, whether it's the transition from day to night or... so that's kind of my framework for looking at relationship to the earth and how my own practices or the practices I teach are framed in the world. They're all framed around those moments of transition when there's access to more.
Thank you. And my last question, and this is based on the conversation we had yesterday. Ari and I were so impressed by you had spent some time after Nixon was elected to time abroad, a portion of your time abroad. And at this time, with the difficulties that we're having with what's going on in America right now, that you want to stay, and it's your place here not to give up. And I was wondering if you would go a little bit into that, because we found that very inspiring.
Yeah, 1968, late 1960s, I was working for a news agency, and I was in Chicago, and I was very much involved in the demonstrations particularly around the Democratic Convention. And I saw a lot of my friends were journalists and photographers and news people, and I saw them, we went through the being tear gassed and being beaten up and all of that. And when Nixon was elected, my husband and I decided to leave, said we didn't want to live in a country like this. And we went to Europe, and it was a really important thing for me, I think, because moving to Europe gave me a sense of, I'd never seen myself as an American. I'd always seen myself as a Black Indian in America, and all of a sudden I got to Europe and I was an American before anything else, and that really, I had to reshape myself inside of that. In that time in Europe. And we stayed gone for 12 years and then came back. And part of the coming back was the beginning of the European Union. And part of the coming back was being drawn back to the land where my placenta was buried, being drawn back to Turtle Island, and thinking about, you know, this many years later, when this last election happened, I'm living here in the United States in on Turtle Island, and I have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren here, and there's no way I'm leaving. I'm not leaving the place of my birth, and I'm not leaving the generations after me to dream themselves into the future by themselves. So it's you know, part of it is life experience, and part of it is that I have family now, several generations. It's the first time in our family that anybody's lived long enough to have great-grandchildren. And so I'm pretty excited about that, and to leave that would feel really unconscionable to me at the moment.
Well, thank you, and we're so glad that you're here and you're staying.
Thank you. Thank you for the question.
So beautiful to hear about the multiple generations that you're anchoring here to trees. I wanted to ask, are there particular practices or rituals that you do with your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren at this point to weave that connection?
For my grandchildren's early life, I owned land out in the Southwest, and we gathered and did ceremony every year. Every summer, we gathered for 3 months, and we would get together and do ceremony. And I had a moment about 12 years ago when I just was not sure that I wanted to perpetuate the idea of ownership any longer with my own actions. And so I decided not to own anything anymore. And so we have been really working within our extended family of relatives to find ways to gather and pass on teachings and be creative about that in the last 12 years. But it's still going on. And we're also looking to, my oldest daughter and I are looking to other elders outside of our tribe to pass on teachings and ways of being that feel like they hold the indigenous mind to my great-grandchildren and to give my granddaughter access to other elders in terms of the long haul. I have no idea how much longer I'll be here, and she needs to have elders that she can look to outside of her mother that are, you know, who dreamt, the generation that dreamt her into being. She needs to have relationships. So we're making relationship with other elders in other tribes.
That's remarkable. Two things. First, that you would gather as a family 3 months to honor these ceremonies and to show up to remember together is extraordinary. And then that you made that decision to step back from ownership is also tremendous. Can you speak a little bit more about that decision?
The idea of ownership and of land is really not in my cosmology, and it's a little bit like, you know, trying to own your leg or your arm, or, you know, it doesn't really. And I've known that for a long time, but I also come with the, you know, your own safety and sovereignty on a piece of land that you own, you know. And those were in tension with me for a long time. And then I went, but if I actually do this, then I am actually saying I want to be complicit. And I'm going to be complicit in even renting. But do I want my primary action to be being complicit with that idea? And, you know, I teach a course called Indigenous Minds, so I trace the legislation and the treaties that kind of bring ownership into the forefront and how decimating it's been to Native cultures in this country. And so I kept thinking to myself, how can I teach this and still own this ranch? This feels really out of alignment. And so all of that kind of got me to this moment, and I went, okay, I'm going to change what I can change, and I can change the fact that I own it. And I want to be places where I can steward land and be in relationship with the First Peoples of that place.
There is such an integrity to the way that you've lived your life and made decisions. It's quite stunning and hard to, you know, to take in almost. Thank you for that, and for all that you've shared on this call. Arya, before we close, did you have any final kind of questions or words that you'd like to share before we conclude?
I also just want to say I feel the same way that of what you just said, Pavi, that I am. You are just, even though I'm actually in years, I think I'm a little older than you, Two Trees, but you are an elder to me in your wisdom and integrity and the choices you've made and your journey, and just thank you so much. And thank you, Pavi, for the wonderful questions that you've asked and the depth that you've explored with Two Trees.
And I'd like to say that I really want to, I'm in it with all of you, and that I really appreciate the chance to speak with you, not to you, and that the way that you've opened your circle to me feels like just more grace in the world, more love in the world, and I'm really appreciative of that.
Two Trees, we are almost finished, and we will let you go on to the rest of your day, but before that, we have one final question that we ask all of our guests, and that is, what can we as the extended Awaken service space community do to help further and support your work in the world?
The first is what I would always say is practice gratitude. I mean, it's amazing that we have the chance to even connect with each other in this way, but gratitude for the gift of life, just us all practicing gratitude for one another and for the gift of life that the planet and the flow of grace afford us, I feel like is a great boost to any work in the world. And the second is to keep remembering that we're connected and that our breath is shared, and that also shares this work in the world. In whatever calling it is that your breath is giving life force to.
It's an exquisite answer and a beautiful ending note for our call. We end as we began, with a few minutes in silence to give gratitude for all that we've received. At the end of our gratitude, I will unmute all our callers so that they can express their thank you verbally before we scatter to the winds today. So first, a few minutes in silence. Thank you all. I am going to turn off, I'm going to unmute our callers, and on the count of three, we will say thank you to Two Trees. One, two, three.
Thank you, Two Trees.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.